Thanks for coming. This is my first time going through one of these, so I'm learning as much as everybody else. So I'll start off the introductions, and so for some of you who might not know, I'm Jana Saba, and I'm the new Bob Lively. So
you've changed.
A little transformation. Bob retired at the end of October, so I am now responsible for his duties. So Jana Saba with Rocky Mount Power, and with me is a
Devon Street.
Devon Street, thank you. And Nancy
Waddy. Some of you are familiar to me, so I've done this before in the last couple of years. I used to come with Michael Ball, for those that remember Michael Ball. So it's Lottie now versus Kent, but it's nice to be back and see everyone. So we look forward to providing the update for you.
And Jordan White with the commission.
Dave Clark with the commission. I need to say that I have to go to the airport and leave about a quarter till, so okay. I'm not disinterested or uninterested or and Jana, would you spell your last name?
S-A-B-A.
Oh. Simple. Saba?
Saba.
Saba.
Saba as in sabotage. Sabbath.
It's on our time.
Yeah. Oh, for the theme of today.
Thank you.
Vandemore, yes.
Just following the commission.
John Harvey with the commission.
Bob Davis with the Division of Public Utilities. Jeff Heinfeld, Division.
Sean Murray with the Office of Consumer Services.
Brenda Salter with the Division.
Carol Revelt with the Public Service Commission.
Peter Ashcroft with the Utah Office of Energy Development.
Sophie Hayes with Utah Clean Energy.
All right, sounds good. Well, I'll turn the time over to Devin Lynch.
As it says, we're CivicCorp Security, so we've kind of adopted over the last couple of years a four-tier theme to how we approach security, and that's prevent, detect, respond, and recover. And pretty much all of the activities that we do, from a physical, cybersecurity, business continuity standpoint, keep those things in mind, and we're always looking at how they overlap and interact. So, as we just did introductions, so Nancy Lottie, our VP of IT and Security, and myself, Devon Street, so Director of Security and Business Continuity and Information Protection. So CivicCorp Security is really broken down into four disciplines. The first being physical security. And although the overall presentation is around cyber, this is important because we've really tried to integrate the themes, and you'll see why in a few moments, of physical security and cybersecurity and how they need to work together, and they're really the same mission. Just different tools in the same toolbox. So with physical security, just to give you an idea of how we're structured and what we do have a security operations center. So in 2014, we stood up a physical security operations center here at our North Temple office, and it was intended to be the focal point for our alarms, cameras, badging, incident reports, and kind of a one-stop shop to monitor our physical security infrastructure and operations across the enterprise, across the company. It's still there. It's going strong, and we have quite a mature operation on the physical security front there. We also do incident response and investigation. So if there's a break-in, if there's copper theft, if we have a bomb threat, any type of incident, there's some any kind of theft or threat information, we'll do investigations. We partner with local law enforcement, national law enforcement, FBI, Homeland Security. We have a pretty good relationship with the Homeland Security rep here, and actually across the other states as well. And we also can arrange to have protective services and deploy technology. So we have our permanent stable of technology that's deployed at a site, say a substation, for example, or cameras and sensors. But we also have mobile and deployable technology as well. We have some mobile radar units that can detect when somebody's breaking into a facility. We have thermal cameras. We have a number of things that can all be fed back to our security operations center and monitored 24/7. And then we also address SIPS compliance. So as you're familiar with SIPS critical infrastructure protection standards, on the physical security side, it's primarily SIP 6, which deals with the physical protection of the cyber assets. And then SIP 14, which is protecting a site against physical attack. And that's the newest one. And we have a few sites that have come into scope for that here in this area. So we're implementing the measures to bring those sites into compliance and to improve the security around based on a risk assessment and threat information.
Excuse me, what is SIPS? Is that a FERC thing?
It is. NERC. Yeah.
And the 14 tells you the kind of facility that you have to apply the...
Right.
It falls under the standards, right?
Right. So it sets the framework. So you have different sub-requirements. In the first couple, it's, you know, develop a methodology for identifying your sites and then apply that methodology. And then that will help you identify which sites need the additional protections. And then with those sites, you apply a risk assessment, and then you get unaffiliated third party to come in and validate the risk assessment that you perform. So we've gone through those steps. We've identified the sites. We've identified the measures. And now we're in the process of implementing.
When the PG&E substation got shut up 3 or 4 years ago, that's...
Right. That was a big driver. Then we have cybersecurity. So we have also, we're just now in the process of integrating our security operations center to address cybersecurity as well. So we're looking to have an all-source security operations center that looks at both physical and cyber. We're right in the kickoff stage of adding those cyber responsibilities and getting them trained up, getting personnel with the right skill set, getting the tools deployed in our SOC, so that they can be a 24/7 watch office on the cyber side as well. So if something comes up, if there's an alert in one of our systems and it's after hours, they can escalate appropriately, they can clear false alarms, they can do follow-up, and then they can also compare the cyber indicators with the physical indicators to get a bigger picture of what's happening so that we can respond more effectively. They also do incident response and investigation. So if there's, for example, over in one of the other states, we had a stolen laptop that was recovered, so they'll do the forensic investigation of the laptop to see if anybody tried to log into it and get any data off of it. There wasn't, it was just a theft. They'll also investigate if there's any suspected malicious activity or HR function or HR concerns within the network. And we're also piloting a partnership with a managed security services provider. So this is an external party. The pilot is going to be with a big telecom company that will sit outside of our network and monitor all the traffic to see if there's any indicators of an external threat. So they won't be monitoring within our network, but they will be watching threats that are coming towards us and anything that might be going out that looks suspicious. And they'll be able to update the threat information and the indicators on a real-time basis faster than just about anybody else out there. Because they're constantly seeing threats out in the wild on the communications networks, and they have feeds directly from government, private entities, and a number of other sources, so they can stay right on top of the developing threats as they're happening faster than any single private entity can. So they're kind of like a cyber version of a guard sitting outside the door watching, kind of making sure that there aren't any threats coming in or out. We also do security analysis and threat hunting. So you'll see an example here in a few moments, but we do have a team of analysts that do more tier 2 and tier 3. So that's, you know, once the SOC has cleared or has an indicator of some suspicious activity on the network, they would escalate to the analysts. And the analysts would do the deep dive. They would look at all sources, all of the different network activity, workstation logs, all of that to get a better picture of what's actually happening. And then they also do some preventative activities too, to see if there's anything that we can do to tighten up our security in a few different areas, or new procedures or ways to improve based on lessons learned after the fact, so post-incident reviews.
So do they fish your employees?
Oh. Fishing. So we have a very robust fishing program. So we have a slide on that.
We'll get there.
Okay. So those are two of the four disciplines. We also have business continuity, and this is all within the same department. So business continuity group is responsible for maintaining and updating. They don't own, but they do facilitate the updating and maintenance and exercising of our technology recovery plans, which are specific to particular systems. So a system could be like SAP that provides some of our HR information and a number of other areas. It could be SCADA. So they maintain the technology recovery plans, which are intended to if something were to happen, and it may not be a cybersecurity incident or physical, it could be a natural disaster or a number of other things, how can we recover that particular system as quickly as possible, and we have robust plans that outline who's responsible for what the steps are, what all the procedures are, and resources that are available. They also do the business recovery plans. So where the technology recovery plans are based on a particular system, the business recovery plans are based on business processes. So it's the same concept, but it might be like payroll. How do we get checks out to our staff and the employees? How do we buy things in an emergency? How do we continue to function as a company with or without the technology that we are used to? So within the business recovery plans, you do have a technology component, but there's also a manual process component in there as well, so that if the technology's not available, people know where to go, know what to do to continue to function using those manual processes for as long as possible. They do schedule and carry out a number of exercises throughout the year. So they test, sometimes it's a tabletop, sometimes it's a full-blown exercise, the technology recovery and business continuity plans. They also participate in the other large scale exercises. We recently had one for Cascadia, which is simulating a large earthquake west of the Cascades. Basically, Portland becomes beachfront property. How do we fail over to this side of the company and continue operations if that happens? And next year we'll be flipping the script and looking at how to do it the other way around if there are a natural disaster or a regional event. Could be a pandemic, could be an earthquake. How do we fail over across different sides of the company? Also, we have GridX coming up, which is a North America-wide national or international, I guess, continent-level exercise that's coordinated across dozens of utilities and entities who participate at different levels. So we're usually full participants in GridX. It happens every 2 years. And the one coming up in a couple weeks will be GridX 4. So that simulates a large multi-staged incident that we have to respond to kind of in real time based on inputs and injects that the scenario puts out there. And then on the compliance front, we have SIP 8, SIP 9, which deal with business continuity plans and recovery plans around our SIP cyber assets, and then also SIP 14 also plays in as well. And finally, we have the newest group that we're currently in the process of building out. So this is our security technology and controls group. We already have a number of security engineers within the group that already perform this function, but we're expanding that. And really, it's security engineering and technology. It focuses on the oversight and health and care and feeding of our security systems and the technology that does the monitoring that sends us the logs to make sure that we're getting all the inputs we need so the analysts can do their job and do the investigations correctly. They'll also provide oversight of our operational technology, security oversight for our operational technology department, or operational technology. So we have IT, information technology. Our OT is going to be the systems out in the field, the generation plants and substations that actually operate the systems. So that's kind of new, and that we're really excited to kind of build out that relationship and work with the field folks on that and providing some security guidance around that.
And just a key point on that, so that the OT system are the control systems. These are the control systems that basically run the plant. They're tripping units and keeping units running. So traditionally, corporate IT has just gone to the firewall. So our responsibility, how we apply security control stopped at the firewall. Anything that happened on the other side of the firewall was kind of on the business side. So if we had a vulnerability get in, we may not have any awareness of it, no insight to it. But we have the skills within the corporate IT group to actually address that. And just because of the increase in cybersecurity issues, as you're fully aware of, there is no line between IT and OT anymore. So we've really focused this year on bringing that OT responsibility into the corporate IT group. So I think Deb is going to get to, we basically tripled the size of the organization in security. So we went from 5 people to 15. Just to take on this OT responsibility. So we have full responsibility and we'll have full insight and oversight of what happened. Now, we'll have a person in each plant you need to apply this patch to this system and you have, 10 days to do it. So we're going to give them direction because we don't know the control systems within the plants. I mean, they're the experts there. But they'll take direction from us. They have so much time to apply a patch, then they have to demonstrate through compliance, through DevonScript that they actually applied the patch. So we have much a much better view enterprise-wide of, you know, any security issues or potential security issues. That's a significant shift in the company, and it took a little while for our plant folks to get their head around that, but we're making headway on that. So glad to see it happen. We've been trying to do it for years. We just never could get the support to do it, but we finally got over that hurdle this year.
The nice thing, too, is kind of a win-win because the folks out in the field are busy operating the plant. I mean, that's their day job. That's what they do. They don't have time to look at the national threat trends and the latest threat scenarios. So we're kind of taking that off of them. But at the same time, we don't have the direct insight to how the plant operates, for example. So they know that. So it's really is a good partnership that we're pretty excited about. They also have security controls and compliance. So SIP 7, which is more of the IT patching and updates and monitoring for anomalies in the network. And then also IT support for our renewable generation fleet. Some of the resources that we're using, that we're getting to fill this group, come from our renewables fleet, so they'll be bringing their expertise and knowledge with them for the wind and hydro facilities.
Why is that different than the OT, that second one, security oversight of operational technology?
So this will be full support, not just security.
Oh, okay.
So they're, because the folks that are coming in are currently doing, they're actually the ones that are operating, doing the patches, doing the work. So they're coming into the group and they're keeping that role with them. So where for the thermal plants, we'll still have field folks doing it. For the renewables, it's actually our people that will do it. So.
Yeah, I think the other piece of here is the substation. So the transmission side of this also will fall into that renewable generation fleet. So the subs are coming into corporate IT as well, not just the plants.
Right.
And is that different treatment just because the renewables is just a much simpler...
The renewables are much simpler.
Yeah,
I mean, it's simpler, and the expertise is the folks that are coming into IT have that knowledge, and it's not that, it wasn't that big of an effort to bring them in. So we thought, you know, we're trying to get as much of this as we can into corporate IT. So it was just a simple transition more than anything. And we were able to accomplish both by just moving a few people into the corporate IT group where they could still take on the security role but continue their operational role. And, you know, the subs is kind of an interesting one because there's, like Devin said, there's more emerging threats coming in on the substations, on the controls out there. So that might involve even growing it bigger than we have today. It kind of depends on what comes in at the national threat level. But we think it's small enough now on the scopes that we have that we can manage it internally. But that one's still kind of, we're not sure how that one's going to unfold. But for right now, this is the group that's coming in.
So fishing, so this is a real hot topic right now. And the reason this is such a big deal for us, and it should be for everybody, is that first bullet. It's a pretty startling statistic. Over 90% of personal and commercial data breaches nationwide are start with a phishing scam. So every time you open the paper, hear on the news about a big data breach, almost all cases, it's because somebody clicked on a fish. They clicked a link, they opened an attachment, and it wasn't what they thought it was. So because of that, we see there's a number of services out there that do phishing test campaigns. That's their whole service. That's what they do. And according to them, national industry average phishing click rates within an organization are between 12 and 30% on test campaigns. So that means they send out a test fish, and between 12 and 30% of the employees at an organization will click on it and open it up. And if it were real, they would have introduced malware into the environment.
Could be a link or an attachment, either one.
Right. So because of that, in 2016...
So a link meaning just clicking to...
Like a web link. Like you get an email that has a web link and you just click on the link. Or it's an attachment where you have to, like, open it.
Open the attachment.
But it always requires some action.
Right. Yeah.
Not just the email itself.
Not just the email.
No. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on the... Within the company, we filter out and block things like images that might have it embedded. Might have malware embedded, so opening the email wouldn't introduce malware. Now, at home, that might not have that detection in place, but at work, we do have that filter, so you have to take that extra action to introduce the malware. So in September of 2016, we implemented a phishing awareness and improvement program because of this, and we hit pretty hard right out of the gate on awareness, training, test campaigns and
we have posters.
Right, and we saw the results because our click rates on test campaigns went from about 16% in August 2016 to a year-to-date average of 1.3% this whole year.
So that's every employee. So all 5,500 employees are tested on every campaign.
Yeah.
So what is it that's making people not get the message? I'm just curious. I mean,
a lot of it's just people are busy, and they just don't slow down long enough they don't think. And we put a couple things in. So like if you get a phishing email and there's a link in it, but you're not sure, because we do a lot of work with folks out. I mean, like yourselves, if we get an email from you folks, it's not coming from our internal network. So we can cut and paste it into the portal, but it has blocked on each side of the link. So you have to clear the block on each side. So it kind of forces you to, it's like, do I really want to open this email? So it kind of forces people to slow down. And 90% of the time, we'll let that link go through, you know, but they have to go through the extra step to do it. And so after your second, if you're a person that clicks on a phish twice, and we test every week we're testing. So we're running a phishing campaign every week. The first time you have to do a write-up and explain to your supervisor why you opened it. It's like, you know, what were you doing that caused you to open it? The second time, what's the second discipline?
They also have to retake the training.
Oh yeah, they have to retake the training.
Yes. And then
the third one, you get referred to HR for discipline. So I mean, we take it pretty serious. Right. So after the third time, you're kind of on the short list, and you end up on a progressive discipline. And if you continue to do it, then you could ultimately be let go from the company. So, I mean, they take it in, you know, and it's a BHE level program. It's not just Pacific Corps, and we all kind of have the same program. But this last campaign, Devin was telling me this morning on the way over, the last campaign we only had two people that clicked across the entire, I mean, you look at the employee base we have. And our contractors also take the test. It's not just employees. So our entire, we only had two people that click. So, I mean,
so
clearly.
Use really seductive. Like we're talking question about this. The one that got some folks was your vacation balance is negative.
Yeah.
Contact HR right away. Click this.
And we do it around the holidays. You know, when people are clicking on, you know, greeting cards and that kind of stuff. And we had one from HR that said something about benefits, but people were on that like that. You know.
I think our biggest click campaign this year was for free Eclipse glasses.
Yeah.
It was timing because
the
company had actually said officially, like a real message saying that we'll make glasses available to all of our staff. So we'll have more information coming out soon because we're going to give them to you for free.
So given that some of the
we kind of set them up,
are so persuasive, how is the reader to know not to click on them?
We have a pretty robust training program, and what we try to tell people is that there are positive and negative indicators when you open an email. There are things that make you look at it and say, this is suspicious. Like, for example, if every email that comes in from outside our network has an internet and bold letters right in the subject line. So if it's an email that's claiming to be from HR, but it has an internet right in the subject line, that's a clue. We also have bright red in the text. At the very top, it says, like, stop, think. External email. So it's pretending to be an internal organization, but it's coming from outside. That's a clue. Also, there's some other things where if you hover over a link and you see what that pops up, if it's supposed to be google.com and you hover over it and it's got a big long string of that's suspicious, that means it's sending you someplace that's not Google. So there's things like that. We also tell people about positive indicators. I mean, if you have your 5-year service anniversary coming up and you get an email saying congratulations on your 5-year service anniversary, it's not guaranteed it's safe, but it's just something to put in a positive column that, or if you ask a question from somebody and they respond with an answer, it's probably safe. So we try to give people those clues of good things to look for, bad things to look for, weigh it up, and then make the decision.
We have a reward program too. I'll just show you. Go ahead and keep talking. We have a Phish Me button that people can click if they're not sure. So if you do good, and you actually, like, stuff together. If you report a fish, a real fish, and the security team validates that it is a real fish, then they get a coin that they can put on their desk. Which is funny because things like that people get all excited about. They think that's really cool.
So yes, Nancy mentioned we do weekly campaigns now, and all year long we're maintaining an average of 1.3%. So we're pretty proud of that. That's pretty.
And this is a company goal for us. So it's on each of our scorecards every year. Our goal this year was less than 2%. So clearly we're on target to hit our goal for the end of this year, and we're doing 1.5 next year. So we keep kind of raising the bar as far as our year-to-date average.
Did something happen fishing-wise in the company that sort of prompted this intense focus on fishing?
No, it wasn't an incident, a specific incident. It was just really at the BAT executive meeting in January of 16, it kind of became, I mean, clearly, you know, all you have to do is pick up the paper and realize how critical it is. So I think the executive team just decided that, you know, we need to take this more serious. I mean, we're clearly a target. We're a utility company. You know, we have a lot of employees across the BHE companies. So, and, you know, if you have one incident, then it could, you know, spread across our entire enterprise. So I think they just realized it needed to have more focus and needed to be a priority for the company. So we put a really dedicated focus on it starting in 2016.
Congratulations. As far as, like, fishing, we're talking about files and malware and all that stuff. Do you ever do fishing campaigns where they request user login information?
We haven't. We have the capability through our phishing test campaign. Because of the frequency that we do the campaigns, there's a lot of back-end work that goes into it, framing, you know, and then tracking the results and then coordinating with supervisors and HR. So we haven't done that just because of the additional setup it would take, but it is an option. It is something that we would consider. We try to balance it out between just a link and an attachment. Usually it's one of those two ways, but asking somebody to input information is a capability that we'll consider.
We have everybody so paranoid now, though. Yeah. Now they're afraid to click on anything. Yes. And so our fish me, we have in our, when you log into email, there's a little fish me fish in the top of our screen. So if you're not sure, you can just click that and it automatically goes to Devin's team to look at. But it's like, okay, you know, some of the stuff is legit. They're like, oh, no, I'm not going to open it. And we also have people that, you know, like for me, I have a filter. So any email that comes in that's outside the company automatically goes into my internet file. So it doesn't even come into my inbox. So at the end of the day, I scan my 600 emails for, you know, what looks like might be legitimate or not, and I just delete them. So, and I haven't got caught yet.
That's why you're recording.
Yeah, but there's ways we're trying to help people, you know, make it harder to open an email.
So yeah, this is probably one of the top initiatives that make a lot of attention and effort going into.
And then another thing on fishing, so executive report. So each vice president across the company gets their list of employees that clicked. So they know who within the organization needs extra attention and focus on training. And then the presidents get a copy as well, so they can get a company-wide view on who the repeat offenders are and where folks are still maybe having some trouble in the organization.
Well, we try to take a positive, like, improvement is our intent. So that's why we give people, you know, you have to retake the training if you click, and then you have to talk to your supervisor. And it's only after it just persists that we refer people to HR.
We haven't let anybody go yet because
it's a healthy level of paranoia.
Yeah, it is.
It is. And we're really, like, if you get one, you're like, that one's a fish guy. You, like, scream it across nobody click on it. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, word of mouth goes really far.
Yeah. But we're really, yeah, there's been a lot of education around it, though. And some of us, where I get a lot of external email from everybody, so I can't just filter all that stuff out. Well, that'd be nice. Yeah. But I've gotten really good at, like, hovering over to make sure that it is from that person. And there's been a really good level of education.
Yeah.
From someone who was in that, I clicked on that original one. I was in the 16%, and I haven't gotten caught since.
So this is really where it really hit home the importance of combining our physical and cybersecurity functions. So in 2016, I came from the physical security side. I've been with PacifiCorp for almost 10 years. And I started on the physical security side. And in 2016, after we combined organizationally physical and cyber in June, so I didn't have, you know, a deep cybersecurity background and was very focused on the physical side. So July 5th, the day after a long holiday weekend, come into work, everybody's still drinking their coffee. And we had an unannounced penetration test by an outside firm. They were hired by BHE to sneak into the building and try to get domain administration rights. So once they have domain administration rights, they can give themselves access to whatever they want, and they basically own the network. And that was their goal. So we started getting, they snuck into our headquarters building in Portland, and they dropped some thumb drives that contained malware. Not real malware, but fake malware. An astute employee that had been paying attention reported it immediately. So she called me up and handed it over to me, and I gave it to the cyber team. They started analyzing it and saw that it was it contained malware. And then we had started getting reports from people that saw some people trying to tailgate onto the floors, trying to follow behind someone else who badged without swiping their own badges. We started seeing suspicious network activity. So we knew that we had somebody in the building who was up to no good. So throughout the day, that actually was just the morning, one of the cyber analysts and myself started looking at network activity and suspicious cyber, on the cyber side, suspicious activity logins and network connections. And I was comparing that with badge reads, video cameras, lobby cameras, and putting those different sets of tools on the two different disciplines together. We had them out of the building and off the network within about an hour and a half. To the point where they had snuck into a floor and hid out in a conference room. They closed the door. And they found an unoccupied office where there was a computer in there, and they plugged a device into the back that got them initial access. Well, the cyber team and myself, going through the badge records of the video cameras, we were able to find the office, and I was crawling under the desk, found the device, and unplugged it before they were actually able to use it. So we had them out, and we consider that a very successful outcome, that we had them out before they were able to achieve their objective. So they did not get domain administration rights.
Well, they had legitimate-looking badges, too.
Yeah, they created badges that looked real. They didn't actually have access, but they looked like it. They were very sophisticated. This is what they do all day, every day. That's what this company does. They do police stations, military bases, government offices, companies. It was an integrated physical access, social engineering, and a sophisticated cyber attack all in one. And this was about 2 weeks after we had combined our physical and cybersecurity groups into one group. In some other environments, the two groups don't really even talk to each other. And here we were actually comparing notes and were able to track them. So the testers commented afterwards at the end of the exercise that our threat detection and response was in the top 10% of the government and private entities that they've tested. And that's all they do. And so to be in the top 10% and catching them and getting them out the door made us feel pretty good about that. But we did have some lessons learned, some improvements, different ways that, just education and awareness around tailgating and badging, some network improvements. So those are on track for implementation. Had a number of things that are already done and some other activities that are in flight right now. So we brought them back this year to do a similar test, not a covert one where they try to sneak in, but more of a collaborative test on our controls environment. So the SCADA system that operates the grids, our EMS. And they gave us a rating of above average on that. It took them a number of days of hammering away with the security team basically just sitting there watching. We had to stand down. We couldn't actually do anything to inhibit them. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a successful test because we wanted them to find, everything, all the improvements that we could make. And so all of our detection response measures were basically just standing by watching them, and it still took them a lot of effort and a lot of time before they were able to get where they were going. So that we consider that a pretty big success as well. So we're pretty proud of that. So training is a big deal, both on the phishing side and, as you saw, with the integrated threat side. When your employees are aware of the threats and when they know what to do when they encounter one of those threats, it can be a game changer. It can give you the heads up that there's somebody in the building. Because that employee saw that USB stick and knew what to do with it, knew not to plug it into her computer, the file name on there was Executive Compensation Plan for 2017. Real juicy, really exciting. I mean, who wouldn't want to open that file, right? So, but the employee didn't plug it into a computer. She immediately called security, immediately turned it in because it was suspicious. And so training is really important for us. So we require all new personnel, all pre-hire employees, contractors, vendors, anybody who's going to have access, either physical or cyber, has to go through our security training, pre-hired. And then we do annual recurrent, so everybody has to retake the training every year as well. We also do quarterly security bulletins and ad hoc when an issue comes up, if there's a new threat that's out there, or there's some plain protest activity, or there's an incident, or a new tool that's available, like the phishing reporter button, we'll send out ad hoc as well. But a minimum of quarterly security bulletins go out company-wide to address, you know, whatever is a relevant topic at that time. We update our training and our bulletins regularly to be fresh and based on real-world events, because there's always new things out there. There's always new and developing ways that the bad guys are targeting us. And we also have new defensive tools and capabilities as well. So we're always coming up with new ways to stop it, new things that the employees can use to be safer. And in a lot of cases, it's not just at work, but at home too. Just phishing awareness. If you're aware of, if you know how to spot a fish and know what to avoid when you're at work, well, you're less likely to click on a fish at home and compromise your home computer and bank accounts and everything as well. So we try to give people tools that they can take home and protect themselves and their families as well. But various topics, physical security, phishing, cybersecurity best practices, process and project requirements for security, information protection, recovery and resilience measures, and then different contacts and resources. We have a dashboard that we put on our portal, two dashboards, one on physical and one on cyber, every month that shows trends and different activity, different reports, copper theft on the physical side, or how many fish were clicked on the cyber side, as well as developing threats. So those are posted every month. Anybody can go out to the portal and look up the information. It always tells people where to go and if they need assistance or different security resources. So this has been a very busy year. We are in the process, just wrapping up our final phase of implementing the SANS Top 20 Critical Security Controls. So the SANS Top 20, SANS Cybersecurity Organization, they have formalized industry best practices based on different threat sources. So this is, it's an outside entity that's created this framework of 20 different areas and different controls to improve just the overall, pretty much almost everything you can do to improve cybersecurity is covered here. It's like 150 individual sub-controls, and we're just wrapping up our final stage of implementing them. You can see we've been working on this for about 18 months. We started with stage one, which is the first five, and I'll go on the next slide here to show you what they are. Basically, you can see inventory of devices, inventory of software, secure configurations, vulnerability assessments, maintenance, monitoring, email, web browser, malware, configuring your devices properly, controlling access, security skills assessment and appropriate training to fill any gaps, so that's one of them, so CSE-17. Incident response and penetration testing and red team exercises.
I think the difference in this is, we have good security controls across the environment. SIPs drill a lot of it, general computer controls drill a lot of it. But this effort, we are touching every asset across the enterprise. So there is nothing now that doesn't have all these controls sitting on them or supporting them. So that's why it's been such a huge effort. If you think about, I think we had close to 30,000 assets that we had to touch to apply these controls across the enterprise between, generation. The corporate side was already pretty tight just because we have done it for other activities, but we really had a lot of work to do out in the field to achieve these security controls. So the difference is now everything that we run and operate has these controls around it. So it was a pretty steep climb for the company to do that, but we're right on track to have it done by the end of the year.
Because I have to go in a minute, I'm going to ask a question that's a little unrelated, but supply chain controls.
Yeah, there's.
Can you address that?
Sure. So we do have, there is also a SIP standard that's in the pipeline addressing that for our SIP's assets, but any. We do have cybersecurity language that we're incorporating into all of our contracts. So it includes indemnification, cyber insurance, testing, that we expect all of our vendors and third parties to adhere to. They would be compliant with like an ISO standard or a NIST standard as well before we would accept, you know, their connections to our networks. The CSCs as well have a number of protections in there for example, secure configurations and inventory. So if somebody were to supply a server, for example, it has to go through rigorous testing, vetting, and we have separate environments for production tests, and so we wouldn't just implement a new device or install a new device into our network without going through all those processes and procedures. We don't trust automatically anything in our production environment until we are confident that it's doing what it's supposed to do.
And then doesn't you have ways to detect whether something's been embedded in the manufacturing process?
Right. So
some kind of Trojan horse.
Yep. So on CSE3, which is secure configurations, on the hardware side and in some of the firmware and core settings, we would only allow settings that we have authorized, that we've gone through and vetted to say this is doing what it's supposed to do. And on CSE18, which is application software security, it's the same thing on the software side. So if there were malicious code, we have scanning tools that would go through and make sure that there's nothing in there. We also do regular vulnerability assessments under CSE4, looking for known vulnerabilities, looking for missing patches, anything that may have, you know, developed recently since the last patch was rolled out that we could take mitigating steps.
And all that's done in test environments.
Yeah.
None of that's in production.
Right. Right.
So it's rigorously tested in tests. Mm-hmm. So anything that came out would go there before we actually migrated it to production.
And then finally, we're also we're implementing an information security management system where the CSCs are very focused on systems. Regardless of the information or the processes or what they do, all systems that are on our network are being protected through the CSC efforts. An information security management system is more about information. Regardless of the systems. In some cases, it might be on a piece of technology, might be on a server, or it might be a manual process. So an information security management system, it's a benchmark that we're using to develop this framework of policies and procedures to protect cyber, physical, and technical controls to manage risk for a particular scope of information. So it includes risk assessments, understanding what the particular risks to this a particular subset of data are, and then what steps can we put in place to mitigate that risk and address that. So our information security management system, it's just that, it's a system. So we look at the organization, we look at what information we want to protect, we look at the context. So for example, like in a hydro environment, is rust and maintenance going to be an issue? Okay, how do we mitigate that risk against rust? And in other cases, it might be cybersecurity. Plus, there's 114 specific controls addressing everything from capacity. Do we have enough capacity on our servers? To access control, background checks, third-party vendor management, disaster recovery plans, everything. And it's all customized to the organization. So in 2017, our scope for implementing this was residential customer PII, or personally identifiable information. So things like social security numbers, bank account numbers belonging to our residential customers. We piloted one thermal generation plant, our renewables fleet, so all of the wind farms and hydro facilities, and our EMS, or SCADA system. And then next year, we're expanding this to include employee PII, or the rest of the generation fleet, and our third-party energy interfaces. So we're exchanging information real-time with third parties to ensure that that information is accurate. And it's all based on trying to preserve what's called the CIA, so confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So, and addressing any risk to those things for these data types.
So on your last thing, third-party energy interfaces, mm-hmm. You know, the company has contracts for purchasing electricity with things that they've negotiated 5 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And do they have the ability to go into those contracts and say, oh, now you need to do all the cybersecurity stuff? I mean, is that how they...
This would be on our end to ensure that the information that, where those connections are, to make sure that the information that we are feeding into that, and it might be information like timing information, it might be scheduling information, tag out information, to make sure that that's accurate and up to date and protected from an availability standpoint or from an integrity standpoint. So we wouldn't, there is a third party contract piece. Like I said, we're introducing cybersecurity language into all of our contracts. But the majority of the effort on this is going to be on our side to make sure that what we're doing is so that the information that we are putting up and receiving is, you know, is correct and accurate and there when it needs to be there. So that's
deck. Thank you.
Any other questions?
So if I bring over a CD, then do you scan that before it's used?
Yeah, we would scan any removable media and external storage.
Yeah, we don't let anything foreign come in. At least we try not to. Oh, yeah.
We do. We have, so we do on the physical side and on the cyber side, so this is something I'm kind of proud of because it's not really seen it anywhere else. So for certain access, not for all of our access, but so this badge has a thumbprint scanner on the badge itself. So it's a two-factor badge. Not only does it have my photo, and it only has the access that I'm entitled to, but the badge won't even scan on a reader unless I actually put my thumb on it. So if you were to steal my badge, it wouldn't get you in any doors because I has to have my thumb on it. It also has a pulse sensor, so that the thumb still has to be attached to it. You can't just steal the thumb.
You have to be breathing.
Yeah, so we have that. We also have like two-factor for any remote access and off-site access through various methods as well.
And we have 50, we've just moved to 15-character passwords. Yeah. You don't think that's a pain in the neck?
Yeah.
So they're,
do they change frequently?
Only once a year. We agreed that if we went to 15-character, it's hard to come up with 15-character passwords if you remember.
And
you don't have to write it down.
And you can't have them like two together.
It can't have any known words.
It can't have any words in it.
Yeah.
But 15 characters,
they're excruciating.
Yeah, we got a lot of grumbling on that one.
Did you say it can't have any words?
No words. Nope.
So what I tell people is, think of your favorite
acronyms.
Think of your favorite
all
song
acronyms.
Lyrics,
yep.
And just take the first one or two letters from each word in those lyrics, so that you know you kind of remember it that
Could
way.
Could you use Inagata Davida?
Sure.
That's a good one. I'll have to remember that one. Thank you, guys. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Yeah.